we get it underway by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Is the legend true that you were a streaker at Woodstock? Because I've heard that.
I was, but, you know, I was, what was I, 11? So, yeah, really was not anything anyone would remember.
You were a cutting-edge streaker. You were before your time. What do they call you? The male Lolita.
Yes. No one ever
Lolito.
Actually said that.
Lolito. See, I've corrected it.
I like that. Hey, before we talk about a couple of your recent works, I saw this first from you on Twitter and was very sad to hear about the passing of Dale Hawerchuk.
Yeah, 57 years old, right? Very young. And Hawerchuk was one of the best players of the 1980s. He had 100 points in his rookie year, but it wasn't just that he had 100 points his rookie year. He was only 18 years old, and he was known as the mini Gretzky, which is kind of a disservice to him. Although you could score 130 points, as Hawerchuk did once, and still be the mini Gretzky, but he was one of the best passers I've ever seen. He scored over 500 goals. He had a 50-goal season. He was runner-up. Everyone was runner-up in the 80s for the MVP to Gretzky. He was the runner-up in the 84-85 season. And then he was like a third-line checker on the 1987 Canada Cup Team Canada team, which I think is the best team I've ever seen. And they don't mount a couple of their comebacks against Team Soviet Union if Hawerchuk hadn't accepted this role where he just starts throwing the body around. He was just a dynamic, fantastic, exciting player, but you wouldn't have seen him much out east, right? Because this was Winnipeg, and this wasn't all-access TV. This was, like, never on. But great hockey player, gone too soon.
All right, let's talk about a couple of very, very different pieces that you have had published recently. Let's start with a piece in the Jazz Times, a publication not known for its fiction, but they did publish a wonderful work from you that I just think is so unique and so powerful.
Yes, this is their 50th anniversary year. And I would say out of all the places I've ever written for, if you're just looking at the quality of their writing throughout, I would say the Jazz Times is one of the three best places. You can get an education in writing. And I'm probably not like terrifically known as somebody who trots out a lot of compliments about other people's writing, but it is really solid in Jazz Times. And their half-century history, they've never done a short story. And I thought, okay, well, we could do something a bit different here. So I wrote this story. I had it. I hadn't targeted it for Jazz Time. Just worked out that way, called The Day Louis Armstrong Lost His Color. And it's a work of historical fiction via what they term magical realism. And Louis Armstrong wakes up one day in 1935. So this is like pretty early in his career, but after like his big Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, those like West End Blues, those super famous modernistic jazz recordings that changed the history of music as much as anything in the 20th century. He's with the Decca label and wakes up one day with his wife, Alpha, and he's not black anymore. He's a white guy. And he has this big concert to play that night at Carnegie Hall. And that was an especially big deal in the mid-1930s. If you were African-American, because that wasn't a gig that you tended to get, even if you were Louis Armstrong. So the story begins with the situation. How is he going to deal with it? How is he going to perform that night? And also, how are they going to get through the day? And so they go about their morning and their afternoon together, and they end up at all these different spots before the big gig that night.
And I love that. A couple of observations that he makes early on. One is that when he loses his color, he thinks he looks a lot like Colin Clive from Frankenstein.
Yeah, he does. So Louis Armstrong is kind of like famous for like Dizzy Gillespie for his cheeks, but now his cheeks are all caved in, like that sort of cadaverous look of Colin Clive, who was Henry Frankenstein in 1931 Frankenstein. And so this thing, 1935. Has like all of these historical details for people to eat up, and they're all pretty accurate. 1935, Bride of Frankenstein was all the rage, and Colin Clive was in that. Now he looks like this sort of pale, sunken-cheeked English actor who had his own horrible end because he drank a lot. And he has that going against him too. So he's had this happen before, and it sort of worked itself out, but he's never really had a gig this prestigious. It was like one of the things they do is they go to a ball game, and it's a Negro League game, and they're up in the stands, and Josh Gibson, the famous catcher, is his favorite player. And his wife's like, yeah, go talk to Josh. And he's like, I don't want Josh to see me like this. Like, he's all apprehensive because he's lost his color. And I think it's just it's a very human work. And the way it works out at the end, I think, is pretty surprising. But it also just seems to pair quite well with our time. We put so much emphasis, I find it so off-putting, on color, right? I see people making millions of dollars, and their entire stock and trade is writing about the color of people's skin. To me, if your business is people's skin, you're like really not that dissimilar from a slave trader. Like, that personally offends me. So he ends up on the stage and people can't see him. It's almost kind of like when you audition for a gig in classical music, you're behind a screen. But because of his art, you can't mistake who this is. It could only be one person in the world. And again, I think the ending, which I'm not going to give away here, is super surprising, very dramatic, like one of those, oh, I never saw that coming type of thing.
Yes, and I will just say, involves something that Armstrong didn't do, or didn't do very often.
Yes, and people read the story. You can even read it for free up on Jazz Times, and it's up on the news section on my website and my Twitter for the 28 of you follow me. And I still like people who don't do this thing that he doesn't do. I just think when somebody doesn't do it, I just think, okay, respect. I like that. I don't like the kind of jumping through the hoops that people do who do this thing. It doesn't feel organic to me. And I just, you know me, I don't like things that are not just not organic, but born of the deep delved human soul. And that's what I think this story is really about.
Colin Fleming is with us here on Downtown. Now, the other piece I want to talk about, published in the Smart Set, and it's a very personal and poignant essay called Mow the Tiles. It talks, among other things, about the impact that moving has on people, especially young people.
Yeah, my family, we moved twice. So actually, the last time in my life I would say that I was happy was when I was 11 years old. We've talked about this before, and I hope to be happy again. And a lot of that is because of external factors. I've figured out all of the internal stuff, know thyself and all that. I've mastered that, mastered art, but still have these roadblocks in my way externally. But I was very happy when I grew up in this place called Mansfield, Massachusetts, which is mostly well-known because it's adjacent to Foxborough, where the Patriots play. And my dad actually had season tickets before I came along, before they adopted me. And we moved from there when I was 11 to Connecticut, and we were there for 5 years, and then banged a left turn and went out to Chicago, where my mother and my surviving sister, Kara, still live. So I've always been struck by the fact that I don't read anything about moving, and it is so tumultuous for certain kids when you're of an age that you move. It was tumultuous for me because I was already very different at a young age, as you could probably imagine from like my peers. And it was tumultuous for my now late sister, Karen, who had all these behavioral issues and chemical imbalances and things that we didn't know a lot about at the time in terms of how to diagnose those things. You'd almost be considered like a problem child. And over the course of these moves, a number of things transpired. My sister became a heroin addict. My father died when he was only 53 years old, and I was this really great hockey player, and I stopped playing hockey because I realized over the course of these moves that there was something I was far, far better at that I really thought that I was here to do. So in many ways, I grew into myself through these moves, but they were horrible, and I think parts of the essay are, I mean, they're upsetting. Like, I was, when we moved to Chicago and I was in high school, I mean, I didn't have any friends then. I don't have any friends now, but I didn't have any friends then. It was tough in high school. 2 years of high school I didn't once eat lunch in like the cafeteria because I didn't have anybody. So I just sat. I sat in the library and worked on my writing and learned things. And there was this one guidance counselor who said, "You're doing it all wrong. You can't do this. You can't be trying to learn so much." And it was really all I had.
And hockey plays such a key role, as you mentioned, first in the move to Connecticut. That was going to be your way of being accepted by others. And there's a beautiful scene with your dad outside the rink before you go into your first practice.
Right. So my dad and I, we went down to Connecticut early. And we were just in the house together. And there was nothing in the house. There was no furniture or anything like that. So it was almost like this indoor camp out, and this rink which isn't there anymore, and it was like cut out of this forest. It's like really dark, and we're outside in the car, and I'm nervous as hell to go in, right? Like, I don't know these kids, and it was at the end of fifth grade or the start of sixth grade or whatever it was, and I had been ensconced in this place where I fit in really well, and I just remember how dark it was, and it was snowing, and my dad said to me, he said that he was proud of me. And it's just one of those moments where, in and of itself, it's not like, oh, wow, no one's ever said that to their kid. But it's like, when I think about my dad, that's like one of the main moments that occurs to me. And I thought that was like as difficult as things could be. And I've just had this sort of theme, this fugue throughout my life. I don't think that way anymore. I always think like the next day could be more difficult yet. But it was hard, and I went in there, and again, I was able to fit in, but I'd never really had that many friends. It was strange, because I was the best at hockey, and hockey wasn't what I was best at. I'd be in a class like with Shakespeare, and like I had a photographic memory. I knew all the lines. I just say them back, and I was like alienated because of I was on my own. It's almost quite similar to me in publishing right now.
And that skill in hockey, rather than enable you to fit in when you got to Chicago, just led to you being ostracized even more by your peers because you were better than so many of them.
Yeah, that was really difficult going. So I went from a public school to an all-boys school, the thinking being that the hockey there was better. And that was an even harder move because that was summer after sophomore year. So everyone's been together, been friends for a long time, and I displaced someone off of the first line center, and this was someone who was going to go on and play at UNH. And I was done by Christmas of my junior year. I went from being recruited to Division I schools to just I was gone, and people wouldn't pass me the puck. Parents wouldn't associate with my dad in the stands, and I just turned to writing. And it's ironic because if I hadn't played hockey, I would have been dead a long time ago because of the things I have to endure now. I draw on these things when it's like a Saturday morning like the other day, and I don't want to keep going. But after my dad was gone, my mom told me, and this is in the piece, that she'd find him in my bedroom crying. And just like, if you knew my dad, he was like 6'3", stoic seeming, not taciturn, but not like Captain Volubility, right? He could like have a dry humor line, but he was not a fulsome speaker. He was not an emotional man. And that just really staggered me.
You did form a friendship and one that's lasted. And I need to, at some point, I need to meet Schiller, who sounds remarkable.
Yes. I hope I didn't offend him and his family because I sent that. I've had so little contact with him, but he's one of those people that you feel like you just would pick up with them again instantly, and I'm Facebook friends with his wife on my basically defunct Facebook account, and I sent it to her. I said, could you share this with your husband for me? So in Connecticut, I had this friend, like you said, named Schiller, and it really was a close friendship. I as you'd probably expect, I don't really have perfunctory relationships. When I have relationships, they're very deep and lasting and committed. I don't really do acquaintances. That's not who I am, or I struggle to be that way. I'm sort of like Kierkegaard. If it's not passionate, it's not worth doing. And there was talk for a while of me living with with Schiller and staying in Connecticut. And yeah, he was one of the smartest people I've ever known. He's a fireman. And whenever someone says something like, oh, she's smart, she went to Harvard, almost everyone I've ever met who went to an Ivy League school is an absolute moron. Like, I learned nothing in college. Is anyone out there like, you want to, like, oh, I'm smarter than him. Like, do we want to do that? Because, and he was just so grounded. He was so bright. He was so grounded. He was so articulate. And he was a romantic. And in the piece, there's this amazing story about how he meets his future wife. He's at her wedding to, like, the first person she's marrying. And he turns to his buddy and he says, I'm going to marry this woman. And the friend's like, whoa, okay, they're drunky. And Schiller turns up, she gets divorced, and Schiller marries her.
Can you explain, though, the concept you talk of about superfluidity?
Yes, superfluidity is someone who you're not locked in on one single stage or phase or anything of being, but you're still always ultimately yourself. Even when you morph, you're still like underpinned by something that is uniquely you. And I think if you're also not changing, if you don't have that quality of superfluidity, you're not maintaining an identity. So it's almost kind of like a paradox. And I think also, it comes down to that distinction between existing and living. And I don't know. I think it's less now. But I don't know a ton of people who I think of as actually, like, living. Someone's going to tell you what they're most oriented around is being chill and not taking life too serious or seriously. Then that just says to me someone who, they're sitting on the bench. They're not getting in and actually seeing if they rise or they fall or what they might have to adapt or change with. And I think that was something Schiller and I had some very real conversations driving around at night. I mean, neither of us was like very popular. Just the guys you would expect a certain level of machismo, but these were two people who could, and I've always been like this with guy friends or whatever. I could say I love you to each other, or someone has some emotional experience, would cry in front of the other. And yet, you know, everyone knows, like, who listens to this at this point knows, like, oh, geez, wow, that's not really a guy to be tussled with. But we always were able to have that openness. And I found that everyone that I've respected in my life has had that openness. My dad had it. You have it. You have it. I mean, it's just people. I think it's vital, and that's crucial, that notion of superfluidity.
Well, it really is a powerful piece. Both of them are. Check them out in Jazz Times, as well as the Smart Set, Mow the Tile. Such an honest and moving piece. Great stuff, as always. Colin, we thank you for joining us. Hope your week goes well, and we'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Again, visit his website, colinflemminglit.com, and subscribe to the Many Moments More blog.